Well, good morning to all of you. Good to see all of you. I hope you had a great Passover, great days of unleavened bread so far. Night to be in between there. We had a lovely time at the Reynosos with some others and just plenty to eat. Good holy day season so far. In Leviticus 23:6, we are told on the 15th day of the same month is the Feast of Unleavened Bread to the Lord. 7 days you must eat unleavened bread. In the first day you shall have a holy convocation and do no servile work therein, but you shall offer an offering made by fire to the Lord 7 days. In the seventh day is a holy convocation. You shall do no servile work therein. This is an annual Sabbath, a high Sabbath. And we're also told in 1 Corinthians 5, verse 8, the Apostle Paul speaking to the church in Corinth, saying, "Let us keep the feast." And he's specifically talking about the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Let us keep the feast. So this isn't just some old covenant theology. It's also new covenant theology. And there are plenty of other places we could turn to as well. Now, I want to read to you Exodus 14, verses 2 through 3. Exodus 14, 2 through 3, and I'll show that on the board. Israel's at the Red Sea, and the Lord begins instructing Moses. So, here's what he says. "Speak to the children of Israel that they turn and camp before Pihahiroth, before Migdol in the sea, opposite Baal-zephon, and you shall camp before it by the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, 'They're bewildered by the land, and the wilderness has closed them in.'" So there they are, they're at the Red Sea, and they're trapped. They're trapped. And God, in His sovereignty, was setting the Egyptians up. He was about to sack the entire Egyptian army. This was God's doing. Now, when did this occur? It's a good question. When did this occur? In the old Bible correspondence course, the 58 lesson course, lesson number 34, in 1965 that was written, there's a chart on page 8 and 9 detailing the 11th day of Abib to the 21st of Abib. And it specifically states this. You could see it right here. God leads Israelites through Red Sea to safety before daylight. That's in 1965. In 1986, however, in the 32 lesson Bible correspondence course, it states this. "Tradition has it that the miraculous opening of the Red Sea and the completion of the Israelites' escape from slavery took place before dawn on the seventh and last day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Then, on the daylight part of the annual Holy Sabbath, there was a great rejoicing and celebration of their complete delivery from bondage in Egypt." That's in 1986. We progress to the year 2000. This is United Church of God's 12 lesson correspondence course. Quoting from that on page 6, "That is why Paul compares a Christian's deliverance from sin through the sacrifice and assistance of Christ to Israel's deliverance from the Egyptian army at the Red Sea, which probably occurred on the final day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread." So, we have different levels of certainty, don't we? Different levels of certainty. Let me show this here. In 1965, it's pretty definite, God led Israel through the Red Sea. It's certain. He did it. In 1986... tradition. tradition has it that Israel crossed the Red Sea. And now we come to 2000, and it's Israel probably crossed the Red Sea on the seventh day of unleavened bread. So we've gone from a definite crossing to maybe, probably, could have been, and in between tradition. Now, why is that? Why is that? Well, the reason is it's difficult to follow the encampments. There were many encampments, and to try to follow that and say, that's the one, is very difficult. And beyond that, Moses, the writer, never said, you know what? They crossed the Red Sea on the 21st of Abib. That's when it was the last day, the seventh day of unleavened bread. He doesn't say that. There's nothing explicit like that. So, tradition, probably, there's an uncertainty level that we have. It just doesn't tell us when it happened. And yet, in the United Church of God, we do agree on the following. Here's a chart showing some of the sequences of events from the 13th, the 14th, and the 15th. You'll see on the 14th, the days in the Bible, as God starts these days, they begin at twilight at that point. They don't begin like we usually count a day in the morning. It begins here in the evening. So you had the Passover meal on the 14th. Firstborn of Egypt were killed here. You had Pharaoh sending Moses by midnight, and Israel remains in mourning. On the day portion of the 14th, you'll notice they burn their remains of the meal. They bake unleavened cakes. Joseph is mentioned there. Israel gathers at Ramses by armies, host, and divisions. That's important because you're talking 2 to 3 million people, and unless they are organized, they are not going to move very rapidly. I mean, it's hard enough for us to move rapidly, and I've got 4 little kids. So you imagine the organization that they had to have in order to get out of Goshen, out of Ramses. They spoil the Egyptians while they're burying their firstborn. Then you have the 15th, the night of the 15th. You have the night to be much observed here. Israel marches to Sukkoth, about 20 miles. So they're marching on the night to be. 20 miles. What a trip. 20 miles. This is 430 years to the selfsame day. I believe that 430 years is from the promise made to Abraham. Not 430 years in slavery. They were a little over 200 years actually in slavery. And it mentioned 600,000 men. And then in the daylight portion here, Israelites camp at Sukkoth on the first day of unleavened bread. So they marched, they left Goshen, specifically Ramses. They had organized, they marched for about 20 miles, and they camp at Sukkoth. And then you have 7 days of unleavened bread. It says began at the previous evening. And you have the unleavened bread for 7 days. So, on the night of the 14th, the 29th of March this year, Thursday, we had the Passover. And the following night, the beginning of the 15th, the night to be, and then the 15th day, the day portion, we held a sacred service on the Sabbath called the first day of unleavened bread. Now again, when did this happen? When did they cross? Or better, when is the seventh day? When is it in this timeline? Now many turn to Exodus 12:17 to prove that it happened on the last day of unleavened bread. And here's what it says. And you shall observe the feast of unleavened bread For on this very day I brought your host out of the land of Egypt. Therefore you shall observe this day throughout your generations as a statute forever. There is a problem, though. There is a problem. The Feast of Unleavened Bread is 7 days, right? So on this very day, I took you out of Egypt. Is this the first day? Is this the last day? And again, the problem being is it's over several days. It's over several days. So this verse really doesn't prove that much. It doesn't prove that much. The date as to what happened on the 21st of Abib, this seventh day of unleavened bread, is somewhat speculative. It's somewhat speculative. So let's speculate. Let's speculate and then draw some lessons as we conclude today about this day. And I want to start by Numbers 33. Let's turn to Numbers 33, verses 1 through 8. It says, these are the stages of the people of Israel. Stages, it is places, it is the itinerary, the journeys of Israel. So these are the places of the people of Israel when they went out of the land of Egypt by their companies under the leadership of Moses and Aaron. And Moses wrote down their starting places, place by place, stage by stage, by command of the Lord. And these are their places according to their starting places. They set out from Ramses in the first month on the 15th day of the first month. And on the day after the Passover, the people of Israel went out triumphantly in the sight of all the Egyptians, while the Egyptians were burying all their firstborn, whom the Lord struck down among them. On their gods also the Lord executed judgment. Verse 5. So the people of Israel set out from Ramses and camped at Sukkoth. Okay, there's your first encampment. They set out from Sukkoth and camped in Etham, which is on the edge of the wilderness. And they set out from Etham and turned back to Pihahiroth, which is east of Baal-zephon, and they camped before Migdol. And they set out from before Haharoth, that's the same as this. And they passed through the midst of the sea into the wilderness, and they went a 3 days' journey into the wilderness of Etham and camped at Mara. So you have Sukkoth, Etham, Migdol, and then Mara. Now, let's graphically reconstruct this as best we can, building on the previous chart. So here's the previous chart, all this section here. And we have right here, they're marching and they're spending the night here at Sukkoth. Now this is assuming in Numbers. This is assuming that each encampment takes a day. They travel a day. Now that's somewhat logical for us, I think. If I say, well, I started out in Durant, Texas, or Durant, Oklahoma, and I encamped in Sherman. Then after that, I encamped in Plano. And then I encamped in Richardson. And then 3 days later, I went through the wilderness and I camped in Arlington. It seems like a long way here. But that's kind of logical. It's how we talk about where we go. I went here, stayed a night. I went there and stayed a night. And I went there and stayed a night. Now that's not conclusive. It's not conclusive. Again, it could be they went there, stayed 2 or 3 days. But we don't have that stated. So this chart is banking on the fact that it takes a day, 1 day for each encampment. So they go to Sukkoth, they travel another day, they're at Etham, they travel another day, they're at Migdol. then you would have the Red Sea on the 18th. The 18th. Now, this portion right here, the scriptures tell us in Exodus 14, somewhere around midnight, Moses holds out the staff and the seas part. And the children of Israel probably took 6 to 7 hours and they crossed through the Red Sea. They get on the other side. It says, I believe the scriptures talk about the morning watch, which is anywhere from 2 to 6 in the morning. Moses takes his staff out and the sea collapses on the Egyptians and they're killed. According to this chronology, that would happen on the 18th. Now, did you notice back in Numbers 33, previous slide, it says, and they passed through the mist, look at this, they passed through the mist of the sea into the wilderness, and then they went 3 days' journey into the wilderness and camped at Marah. That's interesting, because if you take the 15th or the 18th and you add 3 days to it, what do you get? 18th, 19th, 20th, 21. You get the 21st day of Abib. Now, again, this would sort of point to the fact that they didn't cross the Red Sea on the last day of unleavened bread. They may have been elsewhere. So again, 3 days and you come to the 21st of Abib. Now, do we have a link with an Exodus in terms of a 3-day journey? Is there something in the book of Exodus that talks about a 3-day journey? Well, there is. Exodus chapter 3 and verse 18. This is the Lord speaking to Moses. It says, and they will heed your voice, and you shall come, you and the elders of Israel, to the king of Egypt, and you shall say to them, the Lord God of the Hebrews has met with us, and now please, let us go 3 days' journey into the wilderness, that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. 3 days' journey into the wilderness. Now, after this, the meeting takes place, and we see in chapter 5, verse 3. So they said, the God of the Hebrews has met with us. Please, let us go 3 days' journey into the desert and sacrifice to the Lord our God, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword. It's interesting, there's 3 days there, but he also mentions pestilence, which disease. The diseases the Egyptians had, and they in fact do receive during this period, that comes back around later on. Pharaoh is not very keen on the idea of them leaving, as you might expect. Notice verse 8. He says, you shall lay on them the quota of bricks which they made before. You shall not reduce it, for their idol. Therefore they cry out, saying, let us go and sacrifice to our God. Let more work be laid upon the men, that they may labor in it, and let them not regard false words. So I'm certain he was mocking them and taunting them. You know, they're idle. They just don't have enough to do. So keep them busy. Keep them busy. Well, the officers of Israel, they come to Pharaoh. And this is my translation, the Sweat translation is, you knucklehead, what are you doing? Production's down. You're killing our people. He says in verse 17, response by Pharaoh, you are idle. You're idle. That's the problem. You know, you're idle. Therefore you say, let us go sacrifice to the Lord. Again, let us go, because you're idle. You're idle. You have the plague of frogs in Exodus 8, verse 8. It says, then Pharaoh called for Moses and Aaron and said, entreat the Lord that he may take away the frogs from me and from my people, and I will let the people go that they may sacrifice to the Lord. again, this sacrifice to the Lord. Now, chapter 8, verse 25. Then Pharaoh called for Moses and Aaron and said, "Go sacrifice to your God in the land." Now he's saying, you can go, but you stay in the land. You don't go very far. You stay in the land. Well, we come to the plague of flies. Have your sacrifice here. Moses refuses, and he says in verse 27, "We will go 3 days' journey into the wilderness and sacrifice to the Lord our God as he will command us." So Pharaoh said, "I'll let you go that you may sacrifice to the Lord your God in the wilderness. Only don't go very far away." Verse 29, Moses says, "I will entreat the Lord, but let Pharaoh not deal deceitfully anymore in not letting the people go to sacrifice to the Lord." So now we come to the ninth plague. It's darkness. And Pharaoh calls Moses in Exodus chapter 10, verse 24. Then Pharaoh called to Moses and said, "Go serve the Lord." I've had it. "Go serve the Lord, only let not your flocks and your herds be kept back. Let them stay. Let your little ones go with you." But Moses said, "You must also give us sacrifices and burnt offerings that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. Our livestock also shall go with us. Not a hoof shall be left behind, for we must take some of them to serve the Lord our God. And even we do not know with what we must serve the Lord until we arrive there." That's a great lesson, isn't it? I mean, you think about what he's saying there. We're going to take this livestock. But you know what? Even we don't know what to expect. We don't know how to serve God until we get there. Isn't that how life is very frequently? You go throughout your life and you have a path. You think you know where you're going and you really don't. You really don't. And you come to a point in your life at some place and you say, "I'm not sure. I just know when I get there, God's got something for me to do. And I'll do it. And I'll do it." We don't know with what which we must serve the Lord until we arrive there. Now, what have we established? We've established God told Moses to have a sacrifice. God told Moses to go 3 days into the wilderness. Israel took their flocks and their herds with them for a sacrifice. The reason they'd given for leaving Egypt to Pharaoh was repeatedly about a sacrifice to the Lord, a 3 days' journey into the wilderness. And it says in Numbers 33, verse 8, they crossed the Red Sea and went into the wilderness. They crossed the Red Sea and went into the wilderness. And then it says they journeyed 3 days in the wilderness and camp at Marah. At Marah. Now, again, if 1 day to travel to each campsite, then Sukkoth, the night of the 16th, Etham, the night of the 17th, Migdal, the night of the 18th, add 3 days and you're at 21. And it appears they're camping at Marah on the last day of unleavened bread. What happened at Marah? What happened at Marah? Well, let's read the account in Exodus 15, verse 22. So Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea, and then they went out into the wilderness of Shur, and they went 3 days into the wilderness. Interesting that's repeated there. They went 3 days into the wilderness and found no water. And now when they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. And therefore the name of it was called Marah. And the people complained against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" And so he cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree. When he cast it into the waters, and it's interesting, the Lord showed him a tree. That word "showed" is Torah. He Torah'd him a tree. He instructed him. He taught him. He gave a lesson about the tree. He says, when he cast the tree into the waters were made sweet. There he made a statute and an ordinance for them, and there he tested them and said, if you diligently heed the voice of the Lord your God and do what is right in his sight, give ear to his commandments and keep all his statutes, I will put none of these diseases on you which I have brought on the Egyptians, for I am the God who heals you. Very interesting, isn't it? I am the God who heals you. Let me just summarize this text. They journey 3 days and arrive at Marah. 3 days. The water is undrinkable. It's bitter. They just can't drink it. Israel complains. What are we going to drink? Some commentators say about 3 days is the point at which a human body can survive without water, especially in a desert environment like this. So they're on the verge of just collapsing. What shall we drink? The Lord shows Moses a tree. Moses casts the tree into water, and bitter water is made sweet. God made a statute and an ordinance for Israel. God tested Israel. What are some lessons here? I wish that we had time to really unpack all this. We don't. There's a manifold number of lessons that are possible. I've got 7 here, and we'll try to cover as many as we can. Lesson number 1. We soon forget the miracles. We soon forget the miracles. You think about it. They had just been delivered from Egypt. The Pharaoh let them go. He let them go. They were delivered. They left. They left Egypt. Almost unthinkable. A nation as powerful as Egypt letting these people go? That's amazing. The miracle, the 10 plagues, the miracles that took place, the walking through the Red Sea, through on dry land, that is amazing. And soon they're at Marah saying, what do you have to drink? There's nothing to drink. Now, they'd already complained before, if you remember, at the Red Sea. They had already said to Moses, and there were graves all over Egypt, not only because of the firstborn's death, that amplified it, but Egypt was filled with graves. They kind of honored that. But they say, were there not enough graves in Egypt, Moses? And here, there's no water. We can't drink this stuff. We soon forget the miracles that God does in our lives. That's a great lesson. Remember what God has done for you. Always remember that. Never forget that. Keep that in your mind at all times. Remember what God has done for you. The second lesson is, and it's transparently clear at Marah, that Israel, they needed deliverance from more than just Pharaoh. They needed deliverance from themselves. They needed more than just deliverance from Pharaoh. They needed deliverance from themselves. And in the same way, we need more than just deliverance from Satan and his cohorts, a demon. We need more than that. We need deliverance from our own sins, from our own corruption. They needed deliverance from their grumbling, complaining, their sinful selves. And so the Lord provides Moses with a tree of transformation, likely a type of Messiah. And he shows, he Torahs Moses about the tree. and tells him about it. Now, again, we need deliverance from ourselves. Oftentimes, especially during this 7 days, we reflect upon our sin, don't we? We reflect upon our sin quite a bit. And I think about that and I say, you know what? That's good for me. That's good for me. Remember what Paul said in Romans 7? It says the law is holy, just, and good. It's good for me to reflect upon my sins. Why is that? It keeps me humble. It keeps me humble. It doesn't let my pride just swell up in me. And frankly, I want to know my sin. Why? I want to be kind and gentle and loving to my kids. I don't want to be harsh. I don't want to be harsh to them. I want to correct them in the right way. And sometimes we as parents don't, do we? We lose our cool. You've had it up to here. They drop something and you're just like, in a moment, you just, if I react to that, I'm just going to stop. All of you have done it, haven't you? I want to be kind and gentle to my wife, and sometimes I'm not. I want to do what's good for her. I want to respond at my work appropriately when there's someone coming in the door, and 2 minutes later, another and another and another. I want to have patience. I want to be broken-hearted by my sin. I want to be broken-hearted by it so that I am humble. And pride doesn't swell up. And I start treating everyone as if they're insignificant or unworthy or less than me. It's good for us. It's good for us to know our sins. It really is. In Paul's pre-conversion state, he writes in 1 Timothy 1:13 through 16, I was once a blasphemer and a persecutor and a man of violence. 30 years later, how does he think of himself? Converted state. 30 years later, I am the worst of sinners. Now, I don't think Paul just dwelt upon sin all the time. I don't think he was off balance. But focusing on our sin, it's good for us. It really is good for us. It's good to know our sin. We need deliverance from ourselves. Thirdly, only God can turn the bitter sweet. I'm reminded of Matthew 26:39, and Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. And he goes a little further and he falls down to the ground and says, Father, if possible, please, Father, take this cup from me. But not my will, but your will. It was a bitter cup. He drank the dregs of bitterness. He became sin. Not that he was a sinner. Just like us, when we are declared righteous, it doesn't make it where you don't sin. Jesus was declared a sinner, but he never sinned. That was bitter. That was very bitter. And he drunk that bitterness, drunk it all, so that you could have something so sweet. so that I could have something so sweet, that we could be justified, that He would declare, as Romans 5 verse 6 says, that He justifies the ungodly. Wow. He justifies the ungodly. Only He can turn the bitter sweet. We must also be transformed. Notice the stress on the transformation of the Israelites. The Lord is saying, see me, know me, hear me, love me, obey me, and I will heal you. I'll take care of you. Focus on me. Listen to me. Come to me. Call out for me. They have a new master, and it isn't Pharaoh. They're going to be God-centered, or they are to be, and not Pharaoh-centered. That reminds me of Romans 6, doesn't it? Where Paul writes that we're no longer slaves of sin, but slaves to God. Pharaoh is no longer our master. Now notice the statute and the ordinance. It says, if you diligently heed the voice of the Lord your God and do what is right in His sight and give ear to His commandments and keep all of His statutes, then I will put none of these diseases on you which I brought upon the Egyptians. Now obviously, these are physical issues that the Egyptians experienced. They were physical. So I do think it covers the physical realm. But as we all know, physical manifestations are so often the result of spiritual sin. It's sin, and it results in a physical ailment. Not always, but many times. Ellicott's commentary says, He made for them a statute, an ordinance. God took advantage of the occasion to draw a lesson from it. He promised that as He had healed the waters, so if the Israelites would henceforth faithfully keep His commandments, He would heal them, keeping them free from all the diseases of Egypt and from the far greater evil involved in their own corrupted nature and infirmity. As I said, it's good for us to know our nature. Point five, God is the only healer. He's the great physician. In his work in the Exodus journey, Buckingham speculates that even though the waters were now drinkable, there was still a significant magnesium and calcium content in the water. The laxative effect of this would clean out the digestive system of the children of Israel, cleansing them from common Egyptian ailments such as amoebic dysentery and bilharzia, a weakening disease common among Egyptian peasants. In addition, calcium and magnesium together form the basis of a drug called dolomite, used by some athletes as a performance enhancer in hot weather conditions. At Mara, God provided the right medicine to both clean out their systems and prepare them for a long, hot march to Sinai. He is, and the text in Hebrew is, Jehovah Rapha. He is God the healer. He cures. He heals. He is a physician. He repairs. He thoroughly makes whole. And it's interesting. It's not only what God does. He doesn't just heal. He says, I am. I am the healer. I am. God is love. God is healer. God is healer as well. Point six. We cannot continue in sin. Now, after crossing the Red Sea, which Paul tells us is a type of baptism, they've crossed the Red Sea. They've been baptized. And I'm reminded of Romans 6, verses 1 and verse 14, where Paul asked the rhetorical question, shall we continue in sin? that grace may abound. Now that we've been baptized, now that we've been justified, shall we continue in sin? We've crossed the Red Sea. We've left Egypt. We don't have to contend with Pharaoh anymore. He's dead. Maybe. That's in question. But Pharaoh, we don't have to contend with him. Let's party. Paul says no. And at Marah, there's a statute and an ordinance that says, if you obey me, if you listen to me, if you listen, I will heal you. I will heal them. The Bible illustrator states, another and most significant passage occurs in connection with Israel's sojourn by the bitter well, and which shows the continual obligation of divine ordinances, even in great exigencies. There he made for them a statute and an ordinance, and there he proved them. They were now tested as to their disposition to obey, like the stated and occasional commandments of God. And it is possible that some further instructions were conveyed on divine authority. But the statute and ordinance plainly refer to the solemn assembly which was now to be observed. That's interesting. That could be a Sabbath. But he says it plainly refers to a solemn assembly. Could that be this seventh day of unleavened bread? A high day, a solemn assembly. And lastly, God will test you. God will test you. Now, the thing about God, if you haven't figured this out in life, he doesn't lead you around obstacles. So often he leads you right through them. The most difficult, the most dangerous areas, you're going to go through it. Whether it's your physical suffering, a cancer, you name it. You're going to learn to depend on Jesus Christ and God the Father. You're going to be tested. Everyone in this room will be tested. When you're in the wilderness and you're traveling, you will be tested and tested and tested and tested to know what is in your heart. To know what is in your heart. The desert's not a safe place, but God wants you to trust Him. And again, you know, we don't have to look very far in our journey, in our lives, to see how we are, to see how we respond, and the sins that so easily beset us, which was mentioned on the first day. I looked in my closet. Here's what I found. It's everywhere. I emptied it. But it's like this body of corruption that Paul talks about. And our members are, we're constantly this divided man. In the spirit, I want to do one thing. I'm desiring that. But on the other hand, my body's at war, and it wants, it desires. These eyes desire. This mouth, James says, who can control it? It wants to see, and it wants to criticize, it wants to gossip, it wants to talk. It wants. These are my sins. And I'm concerned about my sins. You should be concerned about your sins. These hands, they want. I desire. And you have to do battle with that, just like I do. Just like I do. Everybody in this room, everybody, is going to be tested and tried. You're going to be put through the ringer. Prior to becoming a Christian, you had a good life, didn't you? It was easy. He's testing you. He wants to know what's in your heart. And He will know. He will find out. He will find out how we react to the vicissitudes in our life. And sometimes not only vicissitudes, the disappointments are actually God's appointments. He appointed you for that disappointment. How do you respond? He's going to train us and test us and show us the mara that each of us have as we journey to the promised land. And if we are humbly willing, He will transform us. Let me conclude. The date as to what happened on the 21st of Abib is not certain. No one knows for sure. It could have been the crossing of the Red Sea, but it could very well be their camping at Mara. They're camping at Mara. But I do know this. I do know this, and these lessons apply. We soon forget the miracles. We need deliverance from ourselves. Only God can turn the bitter sweet. We must be transformed. God is the only healer. We cannot continue in sin and believe it. You just bank on it. He will test you. He will test you. These are some of the lessons you and I need to understand as we continue traveling through this wilderness on our way to the promised land on this last day, this seventh day of Unleavened Bread 2018.